ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post 40, created and hosted by me, journalist and author Sam Baker. My guest this week is a businesswoman, broadcaster, curator, tastemaker, and DJ. She headlines festivals, hosts one of BBC Radio 1's flagship shows, was Europe's biggest female DJ, and she has her own hit podcast, Changes with Annie Mac. And now, as if that wasn't a bloody enough, because let's not forget the two kids, she's written her first novel, Mother, Mother. Oh, and she's cool and nice in the best possible way, not in that I'm too lazy to think of a proper adjective kind of way.
I do think that being in your 40s, in my experience, because I'm only 2 and a bit years in, is possibly like the coolest thing ever.
Over the next 45 minutes, Annie talks about the unexpected impact of turning 40, growing up with her fans and why middle-aged women are a force to be reckoned with. She's candid about saying goodbye to DJing and how it feels to start again professionally, why she's a control fan and how she learnt to be comfortable in her own skin. Plus, she gives me a lesson in radical no-ness. Annie, thank you so much for all your time. Really appreciate it. Can we start with where you are? Are you in a box room? Are you in the rave shed? Where are you?
I'm in a little room at the back of our house that is turned into my writing room, actually. So it's really cozy. I can see the snow falling out the window, which is particularly cozy because I'm nice and warm. And there's a piano in here and some bookshelves and loads of tech, loads of wires. My husband also uses it for his stuff, especially in lockdown. He's been producing songs in here and stuff, so we share it.
And it's got a bit of Offspring art over your shoulder.
Exactly, yes. There's some art, various notes, and my whiteboard over there, which I've been meaning to put on the wall for a long time and haven't, but that's just kind of random ways of scheduling my days. Sometimes I come in and I have like 5 or 6 hours when the kids aren't here, and I get so overwhelmed with all the stuff I want to do that I find that if I just write out a schedule for the 5 hours and kind of place everything in those hours, it really helps.
The stuff that you do, honestly, you're a superhuman woman with everything, and then the podcast on top, and then the book on top of that, and two kids. I cannot wait for the day when I get to ask a bloke this question. But how did you stop the two kids fucking up your career?
So at the start, I just charged on. You know, I had a nanny, and both me and my husband are so lucky to have parents who are willing to get involved and would come down and stay for weekends when I'd be away DJing or touring. So at the start, I didn't. And it wasn't until my second kid came along that I really kind of stopped and was like, OK, what am I doing? And in the last couple of years, I've really changed what I've done. But I think that might be partly because of turning 40 as well, which I know is applicable for this conversation. I do think that being 40 and kind of stopping and looking backwards in my life and kind of coming out of the fog of tiredness that my youngest not sleeping had kind of put me in, that's when I stopped and was like, okay, this isn't sustainable. Basically, I can't keep going in this way. I can't keep trying to do everything, and it's not actually an enjoyable way to live. So yeah, I didn't let them stop me because I had childcare, and I just kept going. Basically, I also, I have to say, after the first kid, I did get very good, probably too good, at saying no, and said no to a lot of things and turned down a lot of things. So I kind of became a little bit more focused in terms of streamlining what I really wanted to do after the first. And then at the second, I became militant at it.
Yeah, I don't think there's any such thing as too good at saying no.
I love saying no. It's something I'm really into.
Have you got any tips for militant no-ness?
Being able to say no well, you have to know yourself and what you want to do and what you don't want to do. So that's the hardest bit, is figuring out what you want. When you know that, the no's are easy. You know, you can just bat stuff away like a ninja. You know, it's easy because it's like, this doesn't fit into what I need and what I want. So for me, the learning how to say no was preceded with learning who I was and what I needed in order to function and be a happy, thriving person. And that was what felt like the achievement. Finally being able to stop for long enough to kind of get some perspective and look inside at what I'm doing and be like, okay, this isn't sustainable, this isn't working, this is what you care about, this is what you don't care about, so let's start saying no.
That's so huge. I think you did that like 10 years before most women do it. I mean, I can't speak about motherhood because I'm not a mother, but you know, for many women I've spoken to, the menopause has been that kind of kicking point when they're like, hang on, who am I and why am I? Yeah. So it's really interesting that you got there so much earlier. Why do you think it was?
I think that I was living my life in fast forward. It felt like that anyway. And there was a point where I had to start trying to live in the present. And there was reasons for living life in fast forward, because when you DJ, when your career is based on performing and doing gigs, you're always having to think ahead. So normally in February, I would be accepting gigs for kind of October, November, you know, the fourth quarter of this year. So you're always having to plan ahead and think ahead. And what happened was I got to a point where I started feeling less and less excited and passionate about doing these gigs I've been doing for years, and everything that came with doing those gigs, the tiredness, the weekend jet lag, the feeling like I wasn't on a level with the crowd that I was playing to, all of that stuff. On a level in terms of they're wasted and I'm sober. Yeah. Like it's kind of, it's a combination of a few levels. Older definitely being one of those. So yeah, you're just forced to look ahead all the time. And in order to be able to put the brakes on that, you have to at some point just be like, I don't know how I'm going to feel in October. It's February now. You know, how do I want to feel in October? What do I want my life to look like then? There was a kind of a situation where I feel like I was forced to look ahead and confront who I was going to be and where I was going in my life that maybe other people don't have because of the nature of their jobs.
It sounds like, I'm listening to you talk, like a kind of a really strong central core of self-confidence almost. I don't know whether self-confidence is the right word, but like, okay, this is me and I know that.
I guess there is, yeah, there's an element of that, of knowing who I am, maybe being comfortable with who I am to the point where there's an element of conviction in those choices. Yeah, I feel comfortable in my own skin, maybe, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, I guess so. It's just really interesting knowing how long it took me to get to that point, just like too bloody long.
I know, yeah. I don't know. People have said that before, and I don't really spend a long time trying to dissect the reason why that would be. It might be something to do with being the fourth of four and being left alone to kind of figure out myself from a young age, not having a lot of fuss over me. I don't know. I love all that kind of trying to find out the psychological reasons behind why people are the way they are, but I've never done it to myself. I like doing it to other people.
Yeah, it's way easier sitting on this side of the mic, isn't it? Going, yeah, and why do you do that? And why do you think that? Well, you're probably used to being both sides of the mic now. Which do you prefer?
I think I prefer your side. For this kind of interview, it's exciting to me because it's a different type of interview where we're talking about the real person who I am right now, a woman in my 40s who's changing direction. And I'm excited to talk about that. But I do love being on the other side. I mean, it's become a huge and much loved part of my livelihood. And it's also something that I feel like I'm nowhere near through learning. There's so much improvement there. And I'm excited about the idea of getting better as an interviewer.
It seems to me like you're a person who likes a challenge. It's almost like you get to a point where you're like at the top or near the top and you go, oh, let's start one of those, or let's learn how to do that. Mm. Is it the learning or the challenge or boredom?
It's not really that. It's interesting because like getting to the top of, if that's what you call it, of doing what I was doing in the music world and the DJ world, there's still so far to go. And I could have gone way, way, way further in that regard if I'd pushed myself and sacrificed more in my life. So I always feel like I've held back a lot in that world. And there's been a conflict there because as a woman and as a lone woman in that world, I felt kind of like I should be proving a point. But equally, I didn't want to change my life that much to the point where I would have to, if you know what I mean. So there's that element. But I think the main thing that I've realized in the last couple of years is that that top was fun. And well, I don't want to belittle it in any way because it meant so much to me and still does. But I think what I've understood in the last few years, having had the space to think about what I want, is that the podcasting and the writing, the actual creating rather than the curating, is where my real passion lies and where it's always been from when I was young, writing journals and studying English lit in uni and all that. I've always wanted to write, but I've just never had the time and the headspace to do it. So it feels like a kind of an awakening of sorts right now, if that doesn't sound too pretentious, where I'm able to just finally give myself the headspace to be a creator. And there's a total terror in it where I feel vulnerable, and I'm used to, as you said, being on the other side, being the curator, the critic. And now I'm laying myself bare, and it's pretty scary, but it's super exhilarating for that. So it's not really about a challenge. I didn't go, I want to prove that I can write a book. It's more just something that I've kind of always wanted to do.
Yes, it's like you've gone from being the person who is credited with breaking other people's careers, the person who gets to say what's good and who isn't. And how did it feel to see the proofs of your book, beautiful proofs of your book,
that's
going
terrifying.
Out into the world? I've read it, you've nothing to worry about.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Yeah, it felt amazing. Like I was counting down the days. It didn't feel real until I had it in my hands and it looked like a book.
It reads like a book as well.
Okay, that's a massive relief. I'm so happy to hear that. Like, no matter how much you can see it on a screen, it's, you know, as you know, it doesn't feel real until it looks like a book and it's in your hands as a book. And that was a really big moment. Then I panicked because there's loads of mistakes in it. And then I panicked even more because I knew that it was being sent out to loads of people and with all these mistakes in it. And, you know, I have a certain way of working and have done in my life as someone who's run businesses and owned businesses and kind of, I'm a control fan. I don't like the word freak. Because I'm not ashamed of wanting to have control and be in control of my career. But the elements of that I found difficult in terms of book writing. But I'm learning a lot about how it all works. This whole process of soliciting people for quotes, I found that really hard. I don't like asking people for help. I don't like asking people for time. I've never had to do that. So I found that very difficult. But again, I'm learning the publishing industry is really nice and people seem to really want to support people and back people up and encourage people. And I've been really bowled over by the sense of community that I'm starting to learn about in this world of book writing and just how supportive it is. It's so lovely.
I think people will always help you if they can, and they will also return the favour as well.
Right.
You know, if you've been kind to someone or supportive or just help them out, or they always return the favour rather than moving on and going next. I was listening to, I don't know, one of your many podcasts. You described yourself as a fair weather writer and said, oh, maybe in my 60s I'll get that. So what fast forwarded your writing from 60 to 40?
I was literally sitting with my husband last night and I was telling him that I was going to do this interview today. And I said I was nervous about it because I haven't really done an interview where I've talked about why I've become a writer. And I said to him, I was like, why did I do it? Can you remember? Like, what was it? What was it like that made me do the course? And he was like, I don't know. You just always wanted to do it, didn't you? I think like it was the summer of 2018. I turned 40 and that, you know, didn't feel like a big deal at the time. I didn't have some mad big party or anything. It was just a passing of a moment that I think afterwards I started feeling the repercussions of it. And afterwards I started thinking, okay, who am I now as someone who's 40? And I started looking backwards for the first time in my life at the last 15 years of running around the world and gallivanting and mm-hmm. being a DJ. And I really felt this urge to want to try and learn something. It wasn't about, again, you know, setting myself a challenge or anything like that. It was about this kind of urge to learn something new. And because I knew that writing was something I'd always wanted to do, and not writing a novel was something I'd always wanted to do, and I didn't trust myself because I'm really impulsive to start one and finish one, I needed help. And so, yeah, I enrolled in this writing course, which was 6 months long. It involved meeting a tutor every 3 weeks and delivering 5,000 words in those 3 weeks. And it was one-on-one and very intensive. And I came out the other end of it with 35,000 words that I had been kind of not forced to, but there was deadlines. I had to meet people who were expecting things, and it really helped. Just that discipline initially, it really helped me to get off the ground. So yeah, I think it was a combination of just turning 40 and just feeling this real kind of visceral urge to try and learn something new. It was a reaction, I guess, to that age and passing that mark.
To any extent, were you starting to feel a bit like you weren't the kind of youngest kid on the decks anymore, and you wanted to do something different, or nothing to do with that, really?
Yeah, no, I mean, 100% it's that. I mean, I've been feeling that for a while. But I mean, it's funny because DJing isn't actually that much of a young man's game. And I say young man because it is predominantly men.
Yeah.
There's a lot of older men DJs out there who I respect and have a lot of time for, from your David Rodigans to your, you know, your Pete Tongs, who are men in their 60s. You know, dance music is relatively young as a genre, and there's people who've been there from the start that are DJing, that are still DJing. But I do understand it's different for women, and maybe it's not different for women, but I personally felt like it was a hard slog to go to uni balls and be DJing to kids who are 18 years old. I don't know, I just felt too old for it in a way. I felt like I'd kind of grown out of it, and they deserved someone who was mad for it and young and wanting to be on their level, and rather than wanting to go home because they needed 6 hours sleep before the kids get up tomorrow. You know what I mean? And that's how I was feeling. And I mean, it's just the truth. It's just how I was feeling at the time. So I did feel more and more like life was getting in the way of my schedule and my working life, as in the rest of my life, my life choices, my family and all of that biz. And I felt like it was harder and harder to sustain both of them. So, you know, I changed the nature of my gigs. I do gigs that are different now for kind of a bit of an older crowd, and I get to play more music that I like. And that is sustainable. And that's brilliant. You know, it's kind of changing who you're playing to and the type of events you're playing at. But it still remains the same that DJing messes up your sleeping pattern. And when you have young kids who get up early in the morning, it's very hard to DJ at the weekends when you are trying to be there for them. And equally, I must say, I got this job in 2015 that meant I was on the radio every day. So that really changed things for me as a DJ, because I was then working 7 days a week, and that was too much. So I had to kind of really try and limit my work to Friday nights so that I had a couple of days off every weekend that I could just be there for them.
Well, tell us about Mother, Mother. Tell the listener about the story and where it came from.
So the book is set in Belfast, and it's a dual narrative where you are in the head of a woman called Mary, who is in her late 30s, and you're also in the head of her son, TJ, who wakes up in the house that he shares with his mum on a Saturday morning, and she's not there. So the story is you're with TJ on his journey to figure out where his mum has gone and why she might have gone anywhere. And then you're also with his mum, Mary, in the present on her journey in a slightly more abstract fashion at the start. But you're also going back and you're learning about Mary, and you're getting these kind of zoomed in scenes of different periods of her life that have kind of all added up to contribute to her state of mind in the present. So it's a bit of a journey book. There's a lot of movement in it, in terms of you're traveling around the city of Belfast. You're hopefully very much in a situation where you are kind of invested in Mary and her life and her journey as a young girl into a woman. And I don't want to kind of reveal what the end is, but...
Oh, God, no spoilers.
It's bleak. It's kind of bleak, isn't it? I finished the book and I was like, God, I've really written a fucking bleak book. I kind of surprised myself with how bleak it was a little bit. And when I went into the publishers and the head of the publishing company sat at a boardroom table and was like, where did this book come from? I'd never been asked that question before. You're the second person to ask that question. And the answer is, I don't know. Like, I can look into the book and I can see people in my life. I can see experiences in my life. But in terms of the actual story, there wasn't a burning story there that I needed to write. What I learned in the process of writing was that sometimes it's okay to start with a scene and allow that scene to become bigger and allow yourself to colour it in, and like a kind of spider's web to grow bigger and to grow strands. And that's what happened. Basically, it started with a scene and then it grew. And I realised as I was writing TJ, who was originally supposed to be the main kind of character of the book, and still is in a way, that the Mary character was one that felt more natural and easy for me to write. So I kind of switched and focused more on her throughout.
I mean, it is sad. I don't know if it's bleak.
Okay, good.
Somebody, I saw a quote, was it Una Mullally? Did she use the word melancholy?
Yeah.
That feels like a good word. But also, we can't really talk about this because it'd be massively spoilery. But I absolutely loved what you did at the very, very, very end.
I'm so happy that you loved that because I was so worried about it.
It's not misery.
No.
You know, it's melancholy. And I'm really sorry to anybody listening going, well, tell us, because I absolutely can't. But I think when you read it, you'll get to the end and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, because I think that is a really big moment for a lot of women. And it symbolises what we've been talking about with you turning 40 and self. You know, to me, it felt like this was the moment where herself could come to the fore.
That's amazing.
I don't know whether I'm putting too much into it.
It's what I wanted. I wanted to convey this kind of parallel happenings of a mother who always, always, always thought of anyone but herself and was kind of obsessively holding her life up through the nurturing of others, and a son who in a very teenage, typical way was only interested in himself, you know, in that quite self-centered way that you don't really look outside and worry about too much. Maybe I'm generalizing here about, you know, what your mother's thinking, basically, and how the parallel happenings of those kind of journeys. So TJ kind of finally learning to look outside himself and Mary finally looking in and kind of confronting what's in there and hopefully wanting to nurture herself for the first time ever.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Do you think you could have written it if you hadn't done your own bit of introspection?
I don't know, Sam. Maybe the introspection that I did served that book in the way that it did. You know, I started writing it just after becoming 40, and then it happened over the course of a year. And in the space of the writing of it, in that year, I did have a very big shift. And maybe some of that did come out in the page where I kind of took the reins of my life and slowed it all down. And the act of writing it as well was really justifying and vindicating all of these doubts of trying something new, because I was loving it so much. Like, I couldn't get over how much I loved the process. And I understand that novel writing can be an absolute pain in the arse. And I'm sure if I'm lucky enough to keep writing novels, I will reach that point. But just this first one for me was so enjoyable because it was so liberating and so freeing. And as we said, years of kind of looking at art and studying art and talking about it and playing it, actually creating it was just the most, it was like an epiphany of sorts for me. And that, along with the kind of pulling back the reins of my DJ career at the same time and being like, whoa, everything just slow down and stop. I'm doing this and it feels great. And I want this to be a bigger part of my life now. I can see how maybe that did subconsciously get into the book somehow, yeah.
I'm interested that you love the process. I kind of hate the process. I think it's because I'm a journalist, and like you were talking about when you were first learning and you were given the deadlines,
right?
And that helped you into the process. I'm utterly deadline dependent, and that's one of the reasons, right, I love doing the podcast, is that A, I love nosing in other people's lives, but also, you know, give me a day that I have to do it by and I'll do it. But if you don't, I'm just like, I just can't make myself. Do you find it easy to kind of get up in the morning and go, right, 1,000 words before lunch? Or how do you do it?
Well, I think because of the nature of how I'm writing at the moment, where I still have so little time to do it, it still feels like a novelty and a bit of a treat to be able to do it. So I think it's a big part of it for me. It's like, right, I've got an hour to sneak in some writing, so I'm going to sneak it in. So it's kind of that. It's like the idea of being able to do it rather than having to do it. Again, because of the nature of having shitloads of other stuff on in my life. I was worried because when I was trying to finish up Mother, I got a weekend to use my friend's office in London at this empty office. And I just said, I just need this weekend. I just need to have time with the book and nothing else, because it's all the pernickety shit, the dates and the, you know, all of that stuff that needs to be on point, and you just need to have a big wall full of fucking post-it notes and make sure that everything is clicking with everything. And going away and coming back to that is just so annoying. So I had like 2 days where I went from like 9 a.m. till literally 1 or 2 a.m. every day, and I just got so lost in it. It was such a buzz, honestly. And I remember cycling home on Boris bikes both of those nights, just being like, wow, that was amazing, because I didn't have to think about anything else but that. And just time just flew. And again, I know this will not always be the case, and I'm sure if I got to a situation where all I had to do every day was write, I'm sure that I would find it difficult. But for now, because it's time that is squeezed and eked out of an already busy schedule doing other shit, it's golden time, and I love it. And I'm learning about how to do it still, because I'm writing something new at the moment, and I'm learning that if I just write something, even if it's shite, it's better than writing nothing. So I'm just trying to exercise that muscle of just writing, and that's what I'm doing.
Is it fiction or non-fiction?
It's fiction again, very much fiction. I realised that the way I've done everything is very upside down and topsy-turvy, and it was very hard to get this book published initially, because people were just like, what the fuck? Like, why aren't you writing about clubs and raving? Like, you are this person that we associate you with, that everyone associates you with. You should be writing about music, you should be writing a memoir. And obviously I did it all the wrong way around, and there was conversations about, should I go away and write a memoir first? But I can't really write a memoir because I can't be truthful. I'd be fired. I don't want to write a memoir either. I want to write fiction, is what I've always wanted to write. So it took a while for people to understand and to be able to put me next to the book. It took a long time, and it was a bit worrying for a while. But there was one editor who got in touch after 24 hours of receiving the proof to say that she cried her eyes out and could she meet. And that was the editor that we went with. And I was so happy that that was the editor that ended up publishing the book, because she read it and enjoyed it for the right reasons, for the reasons I wanted her to.
Yeah, people will always say, well, you've already got a profile, so that helps you, that's giving you a leg up. And in a way it is, but in another way it's going, well, you have to do this thing because this is who we think you are. And what you've done is go, no, this is who I think I am.
Yeah.
And this is what I want to do. And I think it's really impressive that you stuck with that, and that your team as well didn't like pile in on you and go, do the other thing first, Annie, and then you can do that thing.
It's interesting, again, just learning about how books work, like just how long they take to come out. Initially, I was like, that's just untenable. Like, when they agreed to publish it, it was 1.5 years before they'd put it out. I was like, that, what the, like, but I'm so happy in retrospect, because I needed 1 year of that to do about 13 more drafts. and get it right and really hone it. I probably could have done about another five more if I was allowed, to be honest. But I just, I was happy for that time. But also what that time afforded me was the chance to slowly start changing course publicly, you know, doing a podcast where I speak to all sorts of people beyond music, writing little bits here and there, short form, and just allowing people to start perceiving me in a different way. So it's actually been really handy in that way for the length of time for people to hopefully start seeing me as someone who might be able to write a book.
I'm sure there's a whole audience of people from Changes, your podcast, who, I mean, know your background but don't think of you as Annie Mac. Dance, rave, they think of you as Changes and that those more kind of intimate human conversations that are completely in keeping with what you've written.
I mean, it's been interesting because a lot of the people that started out as people who would buy tickets to shows or listen to my radio shows, so started out investing in that rave public persona, which was always just me. It wasn't a persona, it was just me doing lots of gigs. They've grown up with me. A lot of people who listen to Changes, because we see the kind of data of who listens, of kind of women who are in their 30s and 40s who've grown up with me and grown out of that side of things with me and still obviously love music and dancing, but they have to do it in a different way or not as intensely. And that's lovely because it feels like I haven't lost people, but I'm changing with them. And there's something quite nice about that.
Well, that's a community, isn't it? And that kind of sense of belonging.
Exactly. Really. Yeah, feels like that.
I read you saying that maybe you'd have a dance revival when you were 45 and the kids had grown up. And that really interested me because it really resonated with me. That one of the best things about once I passed 50 was that I really started to feel like that. I really started to feel like I was having a, I don't want to say renaissance because it's so wanky, but I felt like I was more me than ever, if you know what I mean. And I was more like, what can I do and, you know, how can I do it and where can I go than I probably had been for a really long time. Everything's changed so much for you anyway lately. Are you thinking ahead at all now? Or are you just thinking, well, I'm just learning to do this and it's like, phew.
I'm always thinking ahead, I guess, in a way, but not that far. I'm thinking more kind of a year or a couple of years ahead at a time. I do think about how I will feel coming out the end of this pandemic, which has kind of come at the same time as me deciding to like back out, making that kind of decision to slowly back out of DJing. There's been a real full stop put on that decision because of the pandemic. And I wonder how I'll feel out the back of it. Will I want to get back in? Will I feel like a bit FOMO-y when all the DJs are back out on the road and doing these amazing gigs? And I think I probably will feel a bit of that and want to get involved in it in a way that feels comfortable to me. I don't know. It's really interesting, the idea of turning 40 and becoming a mother as well. There's something when you work around young people and what is deemed as youth music or whatever, which is Radio 1 obviously. There's something about crossing the threshold of motherhood and middle age where all of your credibility publicly seems kind of like you're not deemed credible anymore in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to articulate. Never said this out loud before, but there's something about like just mums aren't cool. Middle-aged women aren't cool. They're not in a position to dictate or tell you anything about what culture is and what culture should be. I find that really interesting and I struggled with that a bit and I think I relented to it a little bit. The idea of this is who I am now, thus I'm not that person. And whenever someone talks about my job and the power it brings or the kind of influence it has, I shy away from that a lot. I don't feel comfortable with the idea of that. But I do think that being in your 40s, in my experience, because I'm only 2 and a bit years in, is possibly like the coolest thing ever. I feel like there's like this harem of women who are like angry and passionate and smart and emotionally charged and have shit to say and are so fucking bogged down with the mundanities of life that it's hard to say it. And I feel like I love the idea of like middle-aged women coming back and taking over culture and fucking taking over the dance floors and raging, basically.
I love that because I feel like I went through that exact process of working in journalism looking up and thinking, where the fuck are all the older women?
Right.
Where has everybody gone? You know, doing my own thing with Lauren with the pool, and all of the staff were really young. And I don't know whether it came from outside or inside, to be fair. I don't know whether it was them or me.
Yeah.
But I started to feel, like you say, like, who the fuck are you anyway? You know, it was a bit irrelevant, a bit like I wasn't credible. Like, yeah. My opinion didn't count because I was too old. Like I said, I don't know whether that came from them or me. It may well have been an internal shaming kind of thing. I don't know, societal. And now that's gone, and now I feel like, well, fuck you, actually. There's things to do and things to say, and we're not going to go quietly into the hinterland, and yeah, knitting is fine if you can knit, I can't, but you know, I'm going to do my thing, and now my thing might involve knitting and it might involve a blanket on the sofa. But you know, that's my thing. And also, that's why I launched a podcast, because I wanted to talk to other women about how they were feeling and what was coming next. And, you know, so that it didn't feel like if you looked up or, you know, across, that there was nothing to see.
Right.
And I remember reading a piece, in fact, it was on Refinery 29, and I think she maybe interviewed you as well, Sarah Raphael. And she was the editor, and she wrote a piece where she said, basically, I'm only just in my 30s, and already I can count the number of women to aspire to on one hand. And I just thought, whoa.
How sad. It's so fucking sad.
That's sad and scary. And what do you think causes that?
Well, I've been having a lot of conversations about my career recently, obviously with this book happening and podcast happening and all these new strands I'm adding to it. And I had a bit of an epiphany the other day where I was talking to someone and we were talking about, you know, the various things that I could do. You know, there's these options, especially in the music industry, following a lot of my male colleagues, you know, to the big streaming networks, Apple and Spotify, being on Billboard, being on the side of buses, you know, having this huge cultural weight and this kind of cultural omniscience where you're like everywhere, that person who everyone respects. And then I was talking about what I just spoke to you about, this idea of this generations, you know, of women who've grown up with me. And I feel like they're kind of fiercely loyal to me and what I'm doing. And I feel like that I should be very aware of them and of serving them and talking to them, because I am them. And that person said, well, kind of, it's up to you. Like, do you want to be like Johnny Big Balls, like the big guy on the billboards, or do you want to be someone DJing to middle-aged women? It's up to you. And it really struck a nerve with me, because it was like, the middle-aged women are the force for me. Like, they are the cultural voice that I want to hear from and speak to. I am so uninterested in the patriarchy, which I'm so uninterested in the industry side of the music industry, in the power struggles, the ego struggles. I've seen it. I've seen all the major labels run by men trying to outdo each other, outbid each other for acts. It's fucking exhausting. It's so uninteresting to me. I don't care about status in that way. I care about connection. And that's what's been the big epiphany in the last few years, is just what really matters to me. And that's what I care about. So it's kind of, if I can write books and write things and have conversations with people that allow those women to feel seen and heard and stimulated and excited and challenged, then that's everything. That's golden. That would be wonderful. And that's been a lovely thing to learn.
That makes me so happy. Because when you were talking, and I was trying desperately not to interrupt, but I was like sitting here quietly exploding with kind of, because that's what it is, isn't it? It's like the startup experience is like, you know, add three more noughts, you know, tell us some lies about money, you know, sprinkle it with fairy dust, you know, which is just bullshit, basically. All that kind of macho stuff. And you reach a point where you just think, I do not care. And the reality is, you know, we're in that kind of cohort of women. I mean, I'm older than you, who are like used as an insult. Do you want to just be a DJ to middle-aged women? Like, fuck off.
It'd probably be the best party you've ever been to.
Yeah, I'm there. I'm like bagsy tickets when you do that thing. It's a weird thing, isn't it? It is a weird thing.
Well, it makes sense, because all the gatekeepers are male. All the people who have any sort of power over culture still, unfortunately, at the top levels are pretty much men. So
yeah,
that's how it works, and right?
I guess the reality is as well that nobody ever starts an interview with them going, oh, how did you stop your two kids fucking up your career, you know?
Well, I've kind of made a point of that. I wrote a thing for Vice years ago. It's one of the first things I ever wrote, actually, about being a female DJ and being asked all the same questions. And it got such a huge reaction. And in that article, it was like, Pete Tong has six children. And I've never once heard anyone be like, how do you do it? You know, it's interesting. So, yeah, I do try and make a point as an interviewer when I interview dads to talk about being a father. And what's good is that people are willing to talk about it more and more now and in a lovely way. So I think things are changing, definitely.
Cool. I'm going to ask you the questions I always ask. What's your emotional age?
My emotional age, I think I'm probably younger, I think, than what my age is. So I'd say my emotional age is 35, I think.
Why 35 specifically? Any reason?
Because that's my husband's age. And I feel like, I don't know, I just always feel younger than I am. Like, I've always felt like that.
Give us a book recommendation.
So there's this book. Do you know Carol Shields?
Yes.
So it's called Unless. I haven't read any of her other books. My mum just lent me this book. And it was actually the book I was reading around the time that I was writing Mother Mother. And it's about a woman who's 43, going on 44. And she's feeling all of the things that I just talked about in terms of the invisibility of her age and the anger that comes with it. And it's such a brilliantly written novel. It's very elegant and very simplistic in how she writes, but it's very funny, it's very angry, it's just brilliant. I couldn't recommend it higher.
That's brilliant. What advice would you give younger women?
Don't be afraid to be yourself in terms of how to succeed professionally. We need women to act like women and still get to the top without having to take on patterns of behaviour or social ways of being that men feel are the ways that work. So be quiet, be empathetic. If that's who you are, don't be afraid to do that. And your work, I hope, if it's true and authentic, will shine through. And I feel like don't be afraid of hearing no and saying no. Just keep going.
Do you think if enough women do that, it one day break the Johnny Big Bulls system?
I feel like it's horrifically slow. And I feel like because of I've been in this position where I've been a sole woman in a very male-dominated world, I feel very conscious of how it works, where women get to a point where they don't want to compete with the top levels of power, which I didn't. And, you know, obviously I can't generalize. There's women who will be so obsessed with the industry and want to have big staff and be in those boardrooms and making those decisions. And I really hope that we have more of them. But all I can tell you is my experience, which is I got to a certain level and I didn't want to, because of being a woman, a lot of it, my decision making process was, I didn't want to go further. I wanted to turn left and I wanted to do things in a different way, in a kind of more gentle, creative way. And what I feel like is that women maybe won't win or be able to take over from Johnny Big Balls in the way things stand now, but they shouldn't have to, because I feel like as more women gain more independence and more confidence of doing things themselves in their own way and succeeding in that and using a female audience and understanding that a female audience can be the biggest, most loyal, you know, audience you can have, you maybe just cancel out the needing men bit at all and having to replace them. You know, you can just do you and be you and speak to the people that you want to and succeed in your way.
Who's your old bed role model?
I was inspired in my career by a woman called Pam Ghanim, who employed me earlier on in my 20s, and she ran a music kind of PR and new media agency, and I ran her office for her. She was from New York and she ran this business by herself and represented a lot of amazing people, artists. And she was such an inspiration to me to see a woman run a business in London in a world dominated by men again, to see how she spoke to people, to see how tough she was and how fierce she was. And also, most importantly, how she identified that what I wanted to do wasn't really what I was doing with her. What I wanted to do was radio, and how when she discovered that, rather than cast me out, she helped me get in that door and used her contacts to give me an opportunity to get a job at BBC Radio. And that, I feel, is a very inspirational thing to do. When someone goes out of their way to employ you, to train you up, to guide you, then realise that you're not actually going to be able to help them, but helps you anyway. She was a big inspiration to me and still is. Yeah. She's a life coach now.
What's your superpower?
maybe the fact that I like doing things. I come from a family of doers, a busy family. We're not very good at sitting still. My father and my sister, we all just have to be doing things all the time, which can be hugely irritating for my husband. But I think it works in terms of professional life because I just like to be busy and I like filling my time with things.
Last one, how many fucks do you give?
At the moment, very few. Yeah, very few, and it feels fantastic.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Annie, so much for all your time.
And it's such a pleasure.
Being brilliant.
So nice.
I'm so cheered.
Yeah, as I said, I feel quite nervous talking about the book, and it was nice to talk about it with you, so thank you for your questions.
Thank you for listening. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review, and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like to know more about my own experience of shifting, my book, The Shift, How I Lost and Found Myself After 40, and You Can Too, is out now in paperback. See you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there. Especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.